Support for WPR comes from Present Music, performing honest music with guest violist and curator Nadia Sirota, May 9th at 8 at the Milwaukee Art Museum. Tickets and info are at presentmusic.org.
Support for WPR comes from WIPS with Toward One Wisconsin, a conference on equity, diversity, and inclusion, May 7th and 8th in Eau Claire. Registration information and more is at t1w.org.
Hi, I'm Anne Strainchamps, and today on To the Best of Our Knowledge, I want to talk to you about being white. That sounds strange, doesn't it, to talk about whiteness? Because most of the time when we talk about race in America, and we talk about it a lot, we talk about the experience of people of color. But maybe that's a problem. Maybe we're missing something.
I grew up in this almost exclusively white suburb, and it never occurred to me how strange it was that I was living in an all-white space.
Debbie Irving grew up like a lot of white people, almost unaware that she was white.
I didn't understand what racial privilege was at all.
And that's racial privilege in a nutshell. It's when whiteness gets coded as normal or the default.
Exactly. Race was something that belonged to black and brown people. And that can sound so naive, so I would make a distinction between I absolutely knew I was white and I could check that off on a census form, but if you had said to me, Debbie, describe how being white has shaped your worldview, I would have had nothing to say. I couldn't have answered that. I would have thought that was a stupid question.
So today, Debbie Irving is a racial justice educator. She travels the country teaching people how to have uncomfortably honest conversations about race and privilege. And she talks about her own experience of, in her words, waking up white, which, she says, happened embarrassingly late in life.
It was a graduate school course. I was 48 years old. It was only 7 years ago. And I had gone back to get my master's in special education. I was a classroom teacher. And yes, there was a moment. It was the straw that broke the camel's back. And it was the night that I learned about the GI Bill, which was something that I knew my father, who was a World War II veteran, had used, and my uncles had used to get higher education degrees and to buy their first homes. And I learned that the GI Bill was not accessible to most of the 1 million black GIs. The feeling I had in my body when I learned that was a little bit like the night I learned my father dropped dead. It's that feeling of, this can't be true. Tell me this isn't true. Please, I don't want this to be true. It was a shock to my system, and it began a process of grieving where I really had to come to terms with the America I was taught about wasn't really a complete story, that there were a lot of stories I hadn't heard, and it meant that there was discrimination going on in ways I didn't understand.
So I have to ask you, this is one of those uncomfortable moments, because I can imagine that plenty of people of color you've encountered must think, really? You just woke up and realized something that we live with every single day?
Yeah, it's the big elephant in the room. Is that, you know, white people, many, many white people across America think the playing field is level. And so I can see now that people in my life had been trying to get through to me, but I would very silently judge what they were saying and in my head think, oh, man, you got to stop complaining and just go with the program.
Well, I mean, there have been moments for you of greater discomfort. I mean, there's a story you tell in the book, right, about a conference. Oh, there was, what was it? There was a film at a conference for professionals of color. Yeah. Tell that story.
So that was a conference, and it was exclusively for people of color. There were a very small number of white people there. And a group of filmmakers of color in the schools had gotten together, and they're trying again. This is the old story. How can we get white people to understand this? And so they had put together this film. They screened it, and I, of course, was one of the first people to stand up and raise my hand. I had no idea how inappropriate that was, really, in that setting. And I said, I watched the film, but I feel like I need more detail from those stories to get it. Because in the film, people were telling ways in which they had felt marginalized in their school communities. And my comment, and just the look of me, I'm sure, and the sound of me, it just triggered a whole bunch of people, and they really let me have it. And, you know, it was, I was afraid. I was angry. I was defensive. Fortunately, I had a woman beside me who said, just sit down, just sit down and just listen. Just listen. There's a lot of history in this room. And so I did. I took her advice. Otherwise, I think I would have started saying, but I didn't mean it that way. So, you know, that was a day where I really learned, A, how much pain there is. B, that there's an amount, certain amount of entitlement to think I can just stand up in any space and raise my hand and get heard.
Did you take away from that the feeling that you should be a lot more careful in any kind of discussion about race?
Huh. It's funny. I think I took away some of that. What I really took away was that I had to be a lot more resilient. I needed to become much more able to hear feedback and not take it personally. And if I was going to be in this conversation, I just needed to be okay making mistakes. It wasn't that I needed to be perfect. I needed to be okay making mistakes and to really, really learn from each and every one. Because to put a room full, you know, there were probably 150 people of color trying to do their work that day, and I derailed that discussion. That's a huge cost. To not put that cost to good use and do my own learning, that would be, that I wouldn't want to do that. And so the way I put it to use is not to try to be more perfect, but to try to be more resilient and understand what being engaged and being vulnerable and being resilient looks like.
Because I asked because I think that one of the points that you make over and over again is that at least in certain circles of white people, there's this whole culture of niceness. And, you know, the one thing you don't want to do is trigger that kind of rage. And so people just pull back from even having the conversation. Whereas it sounded to me like what you were saying is, no, I don't think we should pull back at all. I think we just learned to get a lot better at taking it.
Exactly. And staying with it. Yeah. I mean, we get a lot of messages not to create conflict. And the problem is, if you spend your life avoiding conflict, you don't develop any skills to navigate it. I mean, it's never comfortable to be in conflict, but I don't freak out about the fact that my stomach is in knots. And I actually have built some skills. Mm. And my family, we've all built skills around it because we now, you know, we don't avoid the elephant in the room anymore.
So there's another story I wanted to ask you about, another moment in your, as you were unpacking your own white privilege, checking your own white privilege. It's a story about a time when you were trying to do something good. You were part of an arts project that was taking inner city kids to see some kind of theater performance, I think.
Oh, yeah. This was my first big move out of college as a in the nonprofit world. I raised money to bring inner city youth to daytime performances in Boston theaters. And so I would organize, you know, 9 or 10 buses, and they would be full of these kids coming from these neighborhoods that I hadn't even stepped foot in yet. And I call it my Robin Hood syndrome because I felt so good that I was using my social connections to raise money to bring kids to the theater. And I was sure that it would be a positive experience for them. Mm-hmm. Because I was only operating from my own perspective. That was a pause. I would have liked that when I was a kid. What I didn't recognize was that I was putting kids on buses, and these were predominantly Black, African-American kids, maybe between the ages of 8 and 12, middle school kids, bringing them to a white, a kind of uptown white space and going into a theater. It wasn't all great for them. It was scary. It was scary to get on a bus. It was scary to go in an all-white space. So that just speaks to the white people are so prone to want to help and fix and think, I thought I knew how to help and fix. And I was so off base. And not to say some of those kids might not have had a good time, but think of the other things that might have been done with that money.
I'm curious, how do you respond to white people who say, and I'm sure you've heard this a lot, I don't feel like I'm better than anybody else because I'm white, and I don't see why I should apologize or feel guilty for being white?
I don't ask people to feel guilty. I mean, if someone said that to me, I won't, you know, why are you leading with guilt? Where's your sense of rage at the injustice? I mean, I think with any kind of privilege, some guilt will be in there too. But there are a lot of feelings. The most important thing to do is to start feeling. Just feel. Because we spend so much time in our heads that the idea of just thinking, if once you start to learn more versions of American history than just the one, if you're white, you've been taught in school and through your family stories and on TV and movies, when you start to learn it, it's going to cause some strong feelings. And if guilt is where you go, let yourself feel it and let it go. But eventually, I hope you get to anger, and I hope you get to motivation to make the system change. Because, you know, guilt and shame are two emotions that will just stop us in our tracks and keep us from making change.
This phrase, check your privilege, is increasingly common in so many settings. And this is the thing that you just raised is really my big question. Who benefits from privilege checking?
The thing about white privilege, and any privilege, class privilege, able-bodied privilege, gender privilege, sexual orientation privilege, health privilege, we can't get rid of it, but you can leverage it. So I have leveraged both my class privilege, which gives me money, and my racial privilege as a white person. Now, I've packaged that in a book that speaks to what the experience of upper-class white privilege can look like. So I'm leveraging it to try to create awareness. But I can't give my privilege away. I walk through the street every day, and I don't get harassed by a policeman. I go in to take out a loan from a bank, and I don't go through the three-month set of hoops that your average person of color will have to go through. There's a host of benefits I get that I don't even know. And being aware of that is important because then I can use that awareness to try to create change in the system.
Well, I guess the question is, you know, how do you do something like what you've done, write this book, and not just make it about yourself?
My brother said to me recently, "Wow, Debbie, you must be so satisfied." And, you know, I thought for a minute, I thought, no, I'm not satisfied. The goal of writing this book wasn't to sell books. The goal of writing this book was to create awareness so that change could happen. I got advice early on from Peggy McIntosh, who wrote a seminal article called Unpacking the Invisible Knapsack. And she said, you can only tell your own story, Debbie. It will resonate with people or it won't, but that's the best thing you can do. It's the best thing all of us can do is tell our own stories. And us, I don't just mean white people. I mean people of all colors. Telling our stories gives us so much insight into the system that we all share.
That's Debbie Irving. She's the author of Waking Up White and Finding Myself in the Story of Race.